All right. Do I have to fool around with this?
I'll do it. Please,
Joel. I'm getting instructions over. My name is Sean, and I'm an alcoholic. And that's the end of the facts. All the rest of this stuff is my opinion, and I'm not an expert on alcoholism, and I'm not a spokesman for Alcoholics Anonymous. But I got some opinions. I've been sober since April 24th, 1974. My home group is the Participation Group in Vancouver, British Columbia, Wednesday night. It's one of the two best groups in the world. I understand you may know of the other one.
You just heard it.
And I'm just delighted to be here. You guys are fantastic hosts. We've been staying at the best bed and breakfast. And we had a wonderful meal last night. You guys really know how to treat drunks. It's nice. Okay, I wonder what the hell I'm going to talk about. I'm the first one. What an awful thing to do. Look at all you people. You're all awake. I was born in Canada. I'm a Canadian. We're the people that invented basketball, the telephone, apple pie, Shania Twain. We want to apologize for Celine Dion. We also started same-sex marriages because we believe that gay people should be just as miserable as the rest of us. So, and we drink. Oh boy, do we drink. We have long winters. And I was born in Victoria, British Columbia, which is right on the west coast, and all I wanted out of that town was out. And I got out as fast as I could. We moved to California, and I started getting drunk at 14. And I got to tell you something, I just loved it. The reason I'm standing here is that I love to drink. I mean, let's make no bones about that. I love getting bombed, blasted, ripped, wrecked, destroyed, smashed, all that wonderful stuff we do to describe what we do. I mean, the first time that I got loaded, I came 2-3 hours later throwing up under a bush, and I could hardly wait to do it again. And it went on from there. By the time I was 18 years old, when I was 17, I discovered the wonderful world of chemicals. It was the 60s, and we kind of expanded the definition of alcoholism, our little generation. When we started stumbling into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, we expanded the definition of sobriety, too, much to some people's chagrin. But I started adding that kind of stuff when I was 17 years old. And when I was 18 years old, I declared myself an alcoholic, and I didn't know that I'd done it. But I'd said the phrase that only an alcoholic says. And if you Al-Anons here are wondering what that is, if you ever hear anybody saying it, you're listening to an alcoholic. If you ever say it, you are an alcoholic. And the phrase is, I can control my drinking. Social drinkers never deal with that concept. Social drinkers, if they do something stupid whilst drinking, they stop drinking, which I think is very bizarre. My father was a falling down, insane alcoholic. My brother and I lived under the same circumstances. He's 22 months younger than I am. My brother has never had a drink. He looked at my father and said, whoa, I'm never going to drink. I looked at my father and went, whoa, I'm never going to drink like that. You know? So I declared myself an alcoholic when I was 18 years old. I started on the great obsession of every abnormal drinker, which is to control and enjoy my drinking. Now, I don't know about you, but I never got control and enjoy in the same room at the same time ever. When I was controlling my drinking, I was miserable. The only way that I've ever liked to drink is wildly out of control. I mean, that's the fun of it. I never drank for the taste or the sociability. I drank for the effect. I mean, I am a stark naked 3 o'clock in the morning, howling at the moon, kind of drunk. That's what I am, you know. Give me, you know, a quart of scotch and whoa, you know, there I go. Yeah. I just love that stuff. I hear people talk at the podium, they say the drinking stopped working for them. If it had ever stopped working for me, I'd have stopped doing it. But from the first moment I drank to the night before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, there was always a moment. You know? I don't know whether it was after the third drink and the fourth pill or the second joint or the, you know, whatever it was, there was a combination that all of a sudden, I was like the eye of the hurricane. I was everything I needed to be. I was absolutely dazzling. You know? Tough, but tender. You know? Sexy, but sensitive. You know? Assertive, aggressive, with compassion. You know? A poet and fast with my fists. I was just gorgeous, you know? And then it would start to slip a little, that feeling, you know? So I'd have another one and kind of prop it up, you know? And then it would be an hour later and I'd be coming to and there'd be a bunch of people around me going, and I knew I'd done it again, you know, whatever it was. Our group one time, about a year ago, we had a discussion on social drinking. A bunch of alcoholics sitting around talking about social drinking. I mean, it was a theoretical meeting. I mean, what the hell do we know about it, you know? So we had this big, we decided that basically what it is you have a couple of drinks and you don't end up naked, you don't end up tattooed, you don't end up married to somebody you don't know their first name, you don't write bad checks, you don't go to jail, and we decided it wasn't worth doing. You know, who would want to do that kind of stuff? So by the time I was 21 years old, I decided I had a talent that the world couldn't live without, and I went to New York and started doing a lot of Broadway shows and started living this kind of life that they write in books. You know, it was just incredible. I was having a ball. And by the time I was in my mid-20s, I was drinking a quart of scotch a day, and I picked up a little non-habit-forming marijuana habit. And I was working the docks. Now, I never bought drugs in alleys because I think that's dangerous. What I found you do is you go to doctors and describe symptoms, and they'll write you prescriptions for whatever you want. You know, so I just got a medical book, figured out a bunch of stuff, and I'd go talk to all three of the doctors that I was seeing. And I found out very rapidly that the wonderful thing about doctors is they don't know how to say goodbye. You know, they don't know how to say get out of my office without writing something. And if you give them the right information, they'll write what you want. So I lived in the wonderful world of chemistry for a long, long time. But by the time I was in my mid-20s, I decided I was in trouble. So I started looking to moral superiors. I don't know if you did this. You know, priests, nuns, Christian brothers, philosophers, psychiatrists, psychologists, you know, sociologists, gurus, and spiritual leaders, and lawyers and judges and policemen. And and they all explained to me that this is your problem, this is what you should do about it. Well, somebody points a finger at me, I bite it off at the knuckle. I don't know about you. I have a learning disability. You know, don't tell me what to do. And, of course, you never did that. You know, the miraculous thing is when I finally arrived at these doors, crawling into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, you never said that. You said a phrase that absolutely saved my life. And I hope you're still saying this to the guys that are stumbling in the doors, is you said, I know how you feel. And none of those people had ever said that. None of those doctors, none of those learned people had ever said that. But you said, I know how you feel. And as soon as you said that, it dampened down the anxiety just enough for me to start learning something. And you never said, this is what you should do about your life. You said, this is what I've done. And so I grabbed onto this thing like I was drowning, which I was. So anyway, I started getting my act together, and I decided what I needed was a good woman, and I found her in an elevator. And we were both going to do a show together. You know, God's really funny. God is just too cool, I got to tell you. I had been slated. I was doing a very big Broadway show in New York at the time, and they were slating me for a co-starring part in London. Because I was a Canadian citizen, I could work in London. And it came within a week of going to London. And if I'd have gotten to London, I'd have been a star, man. I mean, they'd have realized what a potential I had, you know. I'd always lived under the crushing burden of potential. You know, I'm an alcoholic. And I would have been discovered. I would have been a huge star in London, I know that. And then the last week, they cast somebody else in England, and I didn't get it. And as a compensation, they offered me a national tour. And on the third day of rehearsal, I got into an elevator with this little blonde who became the love of my life. And so, you know, every no is always a better yes. And she was cute as hell. I saw her on the first day, you know, in her little leotard, this little dimpled blonde. And She didn't notice me until 3 days later when my back went out and I crawled into rehearsal and zing went the strings of her heart. I didn't realize that for a pre-Al-Anon, a drunk crawling across a hotel lobby was like coming home. She realized at a very deep level that I needed her. So we started our dance of death, you know, with her trying to change the unchangeable. And we eventually tangoed into AA and Al-Anon, but we went around and around a bit. So we started. God, it was wild. And we lived in the theater. You know, we were in the theater. Our friends called us the Campbell Soup Kids. They said we were the cutest couple on the block. And we went to parties, and she drank. I mean, she drank. She was a party-hardy girl, you know. Ken Martini, what the hell girl. I thought it was heaven. You know, cute blonde who drank like I did. Just great. And see, I was in a field where nobody noticed how badly I drank. And I love that. I love telling you that. Because I've heard that from every newcomer I have ever worked with, you know. I'm an actor and we drink a lot. Oh, really? I'm a plumber and we drink a lot. I'm an accountant and we drink a lot. I'm a nun and we drink a lot. Isn't it funny, you know? Wherever we are, people drink a lot. Isn't that strange? Yeah. I love it when Mormons tell me that. I'm a Mormon and we drink a lot. Oh, they are. Man. So anyway, we got a show. We went out to California, and I decided that things were going to be better in California. So we stayed in California, and we got married, and she settled down. And one day we were having our cocktails, as we like to call it, and she had a sip of hers and said, "This is boring," and put it on the coffee table and never drank again. She didn't go through withdrawal, didn't make her unhappy, nothing. She's not a drunk. You know, she just didn't drink again. And then she noticed that I drank. And then all hell broke loose. And eventually what happened is on April 23rd, 1974, I was arrested by the Hollywood Police Department, dead drunk, with my front of my pants from the waistband to the knees, soaked in my own urine, and coming in and out of blackouts. I mean, it was a nightmare. And she wasn't home, luckily. She was off saving somebody who didn't need to be saved. And I was forced to look at my behavior. And for the first time in my life, I put together my behavior with my drinking. That was the first time I had ever seen that. You know, up until 11 o'clock on April 23rd, 1974, I was not an alcoholic. From 11 o'clock on, I was. This is a self-diagnosed disease. It didn't matter how many people suggested that I drank, you know, or said that I drank too much or whatever. Until I put it together, I wasn't an alcoholic. And I've seen that tragedy over the years, you know, where guys, it's obvious they're dying of this disease, but until they put it together firmly in their own mind, you know, it's committing suicide on the installment plan, you know, which is what I was doing. I went to work the next day and, oh, God. I was in real estate at the time, and we were going around to look at new listings, new houses, and I got it. It was my turn to drive. I mean, I had the shake, so thank God I was driving because I could grab the wheel. And I got into the car with three women. One of them had been an Alcoholics Anonymous for 6 years and just loved being an AA. She just talked about being an AA and being a drunk, and she never shut up about it. And and then there's this little lady. She was about 70 years old, named Mary, and she's this cutest little Irish lady in the world, and she drank. She liked her drinks, you know. But it never had any problem. And then there's a woman who was going through a divorce who was concerned that she was drinking too much. So they had this big, long discussion while we're driving around in the morning about alcoholism and situational drinking and periodic drinking and drinking and drinking and drinking and drinking, and I'm dying. And finally we got back to the office. I took this Suzanne aside, who had 6 years of sobriety, and I said the last phrase. You know, I said, "I'm an alcoholic and I have 20 minutes before I go to pieces." And I said it just like that. And she dropped everything. She cleared her calendar and she took me to her place. She sat me down at her dining room table and she 12-stepped me. She brought out the big book. She read chapter 5. She read chapter 3. She read the traditions. I thought, my God, that woman's going to read that entire book. And then she told me her story. Now, my story was sleazy, but hers was disgusting. And I thought, whoa, you know. And she said, we're going to a meeting tonight, and I'm sticking with you today. So I said, okay. And she told me what to expect from Alcoholics Anonymous, what it was going to be like, and all that kind of stuff. And she took me to my first meeting, which was a Wednesday night Los Feliz meeting in Hollywood, California. There were about 400 people there. The room, it was exactly as I feared it was going to be. It was in a church basement. It was filled with smoke. And all those people I never would have drank with were there. And it must have been a slow night for newcomers because they came at me. It was like being dropped into a shark tank. I've never seen so many teeth coming at me in my life. Hi! Oh, and then they started saying all this weird stuff to me. It was like being stoned to death with fridge magnets. Easy does it. Keep coming back. One day at a time. Think, think, think. I'm like, what are these people talking about? And he kept touching me. Man. Hugging me. But you know what? I thought I loved it. I didn't actually love it. I felt safe. For the first time in my life, I felt safe. I felt safe. Now, I don't know where that vast well of insecurity had come from. I was born with it. You know, there's some essential stuff that you're... You know, I got character defects that I've had since I was a week old. I still have them. I don't know what the hell's going on, you know. I've now got some tools to deal with them, and I don't have to inflict them on you. But I still got them. You know, I believe I was born with an alcoholic personality. My wife will tell you that's true. But so anyway, I sat down next to this guy at my first meeting, and the first AA miracle happened. It was a miracle. AA miracle. Because this guy started talking to me. There were 400 people in this room. This guy's talking to me. And his story is exactly the same as mine. He's done everything that I've done, and he's sober. I'm going, whoa, you know? Now, what I didn't remember was that while I was talking to Suzanne that afternoon, she kept jumping up and running out of the room, and I thought, well, with her story, she's obviously got some kidney damage, you know? What I didn't know is the reason this guy's story was exactly the same as mine is he knew my story. She was jumping up and going into the bedroom and calling this guy. She was pumping him the information as I was telling it to her. That's how the old-timers get away with lying in this fellowship. They say, more will be revealed. So the guy became my sponsor. And he started shoving the 12 steps down my throat. I didn't study the 12 steps. I didn't go to groups and read them, you know. I didn't discuss them. I did them, you know, which you can't do. But I did. You know, the first three steps were real easy for me. I mean, my life wasn't unmanageable. It was dribbling down my sleeve. It was, you know, that was the easy one. The second one was, you know, restore us to sanity. That was a little difficult because I was going to meetings in Hollywood, California, and there were some clear crazies. I mean, I was a lightweight as far as crazies at some of those meetings. I mean, you know, holy cow. But they had assigned me a new best friend. They do that in AA. My new best friend was Rich, and Rich had 6 months of sobriety, and he couldn't talk and he couldn't drive. And I had a car and couldn't shut up. So we would drive to meetings, you know, and I'd go, and Rich would sit. The only thing Rich ever said was I would say something and he would say, don't take my inventory. So we were going to this really spiffy meeting that meets on Friday nights in Beverly Hills called the Rodeo Drive meeting. The Rodeo meeting has got about 500 people, and every Beverly Hills caterer who gets sober gets to do the refreshments, you know. So I remember going to that meeting when there was an ice sculpture on the, you know, with the sandwiches. That's the kind of meeting it was. So it was kind of spiffy, and Rich had real thin hair, and it was the 70s. You know, we had big hair in the 70s, and Rich didn't have a lot of it. But what he did with it was miraculous. And so I was picking him up for this meeting, and he had to torture his hair forward and spray it, and then bend it over and push it back and spray it. Pretty heavy. So we all looked like Peter Lawford, you know. And So while he was doing that, he had a big old medical dictionary, and I opened it up and I looked up the word insanity. People kept saying it in meetings, and so I thought, well, I better find out what it was. And it had this great big long definition, but out of it popped a phrase. And this is a part of the definition of insanity. Quote, a seeming inability to learn from one's mistakes. Let me run that by you one more time. A seeming inability to learn from one's mistakes. Well, I took the second step right there. Boom. Bam. I mean, that was me. I lived a completely unexamined life. I mean, I kept waking up with who knows what after doing God knows what, where, I don't know. And instead of trying to figure out how I got there, my main objective was to get the hell out of there. You know, a moving target is harder to hit was my philosophy of life. So I was constantly getting myself into the same situation over and over and over again without ever trying to figure out how I got there. And so the inability to learn from one's mistakes was clearly me, so I took the second step right there. I then came to the third step, which is I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to God as I understand. Now, I was raised an Irish Catholic as opposed to a Roman Catholic, and I... It's different. We take the sacramental wine thing a little further than you guys do, and we make it a lifestyle, us Irish Catholics. And I mean, I lived in alcoholism my entire life. I mean, I come from this huge. Well, one of the terrible secrets of my family is that we're not actually Irish; we're Scottish, and. Which are worse drunks than the Irish. And so we lived in alcoholism. Everybody was falling. Everybody had the failing. Oh, God love me, has the failing. And I mean, it was so. I mean, it was kind of like you know, asking a fish to describe water. It was just simply the element they live in, you know. And so everybody drank. So it was hard to notice alcoholism in my family, unless you did something awful like burn down the house or. Or shoot a close relative. That got people's attention. So anyway, I had a little trouble with God. By the time I arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous, my spiritual life consisted of two alcoholic prayers. The first one is, Dear God, get me out of this and I'll never do it again. And the second alcoholic prayer is, Whew. And, you know, that was the extent of my spiritual life. But luckily, I thought to take the third step, you got to come up with the vestments and the incense and the whole number. You know, you had to have it all in place. But it's not that. It's I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to God as I understand God. I had no understanding of God. I still have no understanding of God. If I understood God, we'd be in big trouble. So what the decision is like, it's like this. That third step is like if I decide to buy a house. If I decide to buy a house, I don't walk into a house. What I do is I buy a newspaper. And I look through the bought ads, and I look at houses, and then I find a real estate agent. The real estate agent takes me around, and we go look at houses, and then we find a house that we like, and we make an offer, and there's a counteroffer, and an offer, and a counteroffer, and an offer. And we buy the house, you know, that's approved. And then we go to the bank, and then we do the title search, and there's the escrow and everything else. So from the time I make the decision to the time I get the keys to the house, there's a whole lot of steps. And that's what the third step is that I made a decision to start living a life that was based on spiritual principles. Something that terrified me and something that was really awful. Because I really thought if I got really, really spiritual in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd end up running a 12-step house in a bad neighborhood. And I didn't really want to do that. But you know what? I was so desperate that I was willing to that if that's what the deal was, okay. You know? The abuse of alcohol had made me sweetly reasonable by the time I arrived at Alcoholics. You know, just beat up. Just beat to death. So, I made the decision and we started on the journey. Now, let me tell you, if this was just a journey, I'd have never taken it. But this is an adventure. This sobriety thing is an adventure. I mean, I'm an adrenaline junkie along with anything else. You know, I love scaring myself to death. I love living on the edge. I love all that stuff. You know, I just love being out there, you know. I don't know if that comes as a big surprise to you or not, but anyway, I just love being out there. And so what my sponsor explained to me, the the miracle guy who was shoving these steps down my throat, was that that this was an adventure. And I love it. I mean, that's what it is. And any great adventure has really good parts to it and really lousy parts to it. And if you think that sobriety is the absence of problems, I got a big surprise for you. Because this is about real life. What this whole program is designed to do is to return us to real life, is to get us out there in real life, living out there, having families out there, being parts of communities, being employees, being employers, living the life, you know? And I wanted that desperately. I didn't want to be one of those guys who was a big deal in AA who couldn't hold a job, you know? Didn't interest me at all. I just wanted to keep coming here and knowing you and getting better and being out there, you know? And so I started on this adventure. And, you know, before you start on some kind of incredible adventure, you got to find out what you're taking on the journey. And that's what the inventory is about. I had to find out what kind of baggage I had, what I was going to take and what I was going to leave. And so I did this thing. My sponsor, I was 3 weeks sober. My sponsor said, you have 3 weeks to do your inventory. Here's the date we're going to do your fifth step. Well, I didn't know you couldn't do it in 3 weeks, you know. So I did it. And when I was 6 weeks sober, I sat down with this man that I'd known for 6 weeks and told him everything about me. That's not my style. I mean, I'll tell you a little bit about me as long as you tell me a little bit about you, and then if you crowd me, I'll threaten to expose you. But suddenly I had this guy who knew everything about me. And let me tell you, the phone calls got real short. You know, they were no longer an hour or half an hour to explain the problem. We could cut right to the bottom line. He had all the info. So it was all laid out. I had somebody in my life who knew me. You know, and one of our problems as alcoholics is our inability to be really intimate, you know. Intimacy is fairly simple. It's, you know, telling you who I am and asking you for what I need. Real easy to say, real hard to do. And I finally had somebody in my life who knew me. And I needed to be known. I just needed to be known. I was a spy in my own life. You know, I was an outlaw. I was an alien. I was an unwelcome guest all my life. And here was somebody that was on my side who knew me. And so what I did was I reported to my guide, and that's what a sponsor is. A sponsor is not a god or a guru. A sponsor is a guide. It's somebody who knows the trail, basically. And he was guiding me on this adventure. So I told him what the baggage was. And then we did the sixth and seventh step, you know, where we got rid of the stuff that was holding me back and tried as best we could to put in place the stuff that I was going to need, the stuff that I didn't have that I was going to need for this adventure. And then before you leave on an adventure, you got to clean up the campground, you know. And that's what the eighth and ninth step's about. It's about cleaning it up so I'm free to move on. And I did that. I did a list of with him. You know, up in our area, there's this whole big thing that you do your fifth step with, like, a priest or a psychologist. This is somebody, you're never going to see again, which is just nonsense. You know, somebody comes back and says, well, I did my fifth step with Father Franahan, and still nobody knows who this guy is. You know, Father Franahan does, but nobody ever sees him. And but then I had this guy. My sponsor used to do this. He said, "Listen, you need to go talk to that guy because he's got a problem like you do, and you can share some." I said, "Wait a minute, did you tell him? Did you tell him?" He said, "No, I just know. You know, go over." So I was forced to go over and share my deepest, darkest secrets with people. You know, and what I found out is my deepest, darkest secrets were pretty boring. You know, I want you to know that way down deep, I'm shallow. I'm probably one of the least interesting human beings on the face of the earth. Thank God, you know. I was fascinated with my problem. You know, the only thing that made me interesting were my desperate secrets. You know, once I got out, people were saying, "That's it? That's what we've been talking about here?" Yeah. So, by the time I'd done my nine, that book. I don't know whoever wrote that book. I don't think it was Bill. I mean, when you're halfway through the ninth step, things get better. I mean, things get really better. You start feeling better. You start feeling like not better than and less than. You start feeling even with doing amends. Oh, man. there's a lot of reasons I stay sober, but you know, I don't want to do those amends again. You know, it keeps me from doing a lot of dumb stuff. You know, because I know if I do this, I've got to make an amends for it, and I hate making. Oh man, you know, and you know, at first there's a real adrenaline rush because you don't know how people are going to react when you say, you know, I'm sorry I threw up on your Christmas tree, but I have this disease. And a lot of times they were so drunk they don't remember it either. And you know, some of them get angry and some of them go, oh, please. You know, so, you know, I've got a guy who's going through it. He keeps calling me every day. This miracle. Oh, I've been in a mess and they didn't throw me out of the office. Great. And anyway, I did all that kind of stuff. And then comes the 10th step. And the 10th step is about keeping my side of the street clean. And that's on a daily basis. Now, see, I told you I was raised an Irish Catholic, so I had a lot of trouble with the 10th step at first because I come from a religion that if you thought about it, you've done it. And I'm a thinker, you know. And, so I carried around a lot of stuff, you know. And so I started doing the 10th step. What did I do right today? What did I do wrong today? Well, I couldn't remember anything right I'd done. All I could remember is what I did wrong, you know. And so I talked to my sponsor about it, so I decided to do, what did I do today that I approve of, and what did I do today that I don't approve of? And the stuff I approve of, I said, okay, thanks God for giving me the insight to do that right. And the stuff I don't approve of, I set out to change. And that's made it easier for me to kind of get through that. And then the 11th step comes up, and that's prayer and meditation. Ha! Now, I'm a child of the 60s. I know about meditation. I mean, you light up a big bong, and you listen to sitar music, and you meditate. And I thought meditation was you get quiet enough so that God will let you know what's coming up. I was using meditation for fortune telling was what I was doing. Instead, meditating long enough to just be still with who I am right now at this moment so I can react to my life as I'm living my life instead of projecting my life like I should live it somewhere out there. And I've fiddled around with it. I mean, I've gotten highly spiritual in this program at times. I mean, so spiritual, I was no earthly good. You know that spiritual? I've been there, you know. At one point in my life, I was probably in danger of being crushed to death by a falling bookshelf of spiritual literature. But I've gotten it down kind of simple now. What I basically do as far as my meditation is I try to get quiet a couple of times a day at the beginning of the day, at the end, and I concentrate on the phrase, be still and know that I am God. And I break that phrase down word by word, be, just sit, just be, you know, just be. Listen to my breathing, hear the gurgling of my stomach, you know, the radio in the next place, the traffic going by, just be. Be still, just stop moving. Just breathe in, breathe out, just stop, be still. Be still and know, and what that is about is just opening up my head, be still and know. And be still and know that. That I'm now completely open, you know, and then be still and know that I am. And what that is that little voice that's in the center of my life, what we call intuition, what the nuns call the soul, whatever it is that connects me to you and ultimately to a power greater than me, be still and know that I am. And then it identifies itself. Be still and know that I am God. Because I really believe that I carry around a little microchip of God within us. I believe that we all do. I believe that we're all created in the image and likeness of God. I don't think it's the way we look. I think it's the way we act. You know, when somebody gets to the meeting at 6 o'clock and puts on the coffee for the group, I can see the family resemblance. You know, when somebody gets on the bus and goes to central office and gets literature and brings a big box back on the bus, I can see the family resemblance. When some little old lady says to some little 15-year-old chick who's tattooed from head to toe, come sit next to me, dear, I can see the family resemblance. I can see it when some guy holds another guy as the guy breaks down in tears and cries for the first time in his adult life. I can see the family resemblance. I can see the way we look like each other when we're being loving. And I see it all the time in these rooms. It's one of the reasons I keep coming back. And that's why I love this fellowship. And so I believe that that's how I've come to live with the idea of spiritual principles and the idea of something far greater than me, is that I believe we connect to each other through that that voice that we've ignored for so many years, for so long while we were practicing our disease. And that this fellowship enables us to listen to finally for the first time. And that connects to the voice in you. That's how I can look at you and say, I know how you feel, you know. And this is what I've done with my life. And that's the 11th step for me. And then comes the 12th step. And the 12th step is in three parts. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. That's the promise in the second step. The promise in the second step is that I'll be restored to sanity. And I believe that the way that I'm restored to sanity, the alcoholic of my type, is that I have some kind of spiritual awakening. No, I was waiting for a spiritual event. You know, I was waiting for a burning bush or the wind to blow up my butt like Bill Wilson. You know, I was waiting for some big deal, you know. And so far that has not happened. What has happened to me is the evolutionary variety. You know, they talk about in the spiritual experience, the appendix. It's been an evolving thing, an evolving sense of peace, an evolving sense of being connected, an evolving sense of being a worthwhile human being. And also what happens to us is we get a sense of wonder restored to us. By the time I arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was terrified and cynical at the same time. Not a great combination. Angry and terrified, you know. I didn't think anything was cute. I didn't think anything was wonderful. I didn't think anything like that, yeah. So you stick around here and you develop AA eyes, you know, those big, soft, kind of dumb eyes, you know. We all look like deer, you know. You know. I find myself crying at supermarket openings and card tricks and, you know. Look at that sunset. Yeah. Talk about getting in touch with your feelings. But the sense of wonder, the sense of awe. You know, our daughter was born in sobriety and we didn't belong to any kind of organized religion. I found my spiritual life in Alcoholics Anonymous and that was fine with me. I never went back to being an altar boy. So we came up with the problem is how are we going to teach our daughter about spirituality? And my sponsor's wife is just a hoot. Her name is Ruby. And Ruby runs around saying, God is too cool. Ruby says, look, I mean, four kinds of tulips would have been fine. But 250? God is too cool. We have been fine with a dozen butterflies, but there's about 375 different kinds of butterflies. God is... So that's what we taught Kate. So Kate runs around and goes, God is too cool. Yeah, it's just great. And then we carry the message to alcoholics who still suffer. And the obvious alcoholics who still suffer are the ones that are moving, you know, coming into the rooms. I mean, those are the really obvious ones, the brand new ones. But alcoholics suffer in sobriety too. Let me tell you this adventure thing. You know, a great adventure has really great parts and really lousy parts. And I'll be 30 years sober in April, which is just unbelievable. But I've been rich and I've been poor at Alcoholics Anonymous. I prefer the problems of being rich to the problems of being poor. But they all got problems. You know, I've found out that stuff doesn't fix you or protect you. I've found out that it's an inside job. It has to do with my relationship with my higher power. That's the most thing. I mean, we've gone broke. I've gotten cancer. I've got a heart thing that's going on. I mean, you know, we've done it all. You know, we've been to the most incredible places in the world because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've had great jobs. I've lost great jobs. I've had other jobs that weren't great. You know, the whole thing. I mean, you know, this is not about protecting us from life here. It's about us embracing life on life's terms. And sometimes life's terms are lousy. You know, we lose people out of our lives. I know more dead people than anybody I know, you know. People before the program, people who come to the program. My best friend, Rich, was one of the first people to die of AIDS, you know, when they still called it gay cancer. And I would go visit him in the hospital, and they had him in this isolation pod, and nobody was supposed to go near him without gloves and masks and everything else. And I used to go in and push him over to the side of his bed and sit on his bed and read a book. He was so desperately lonely that it was just having somebody there. And he would curl over, put his arms around me, and go to sleep. And the nurses would come in and freak, you know. And I kept saying, relax, kid. I'm not going to get it from spit or anything else, you know. And nobody knew. But you know, and I was there for when he you know, when he died. That kind of stuff happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's just the way it goes. I've been fired. I've been on, you know, I've been like the spiritual speaker at a great big huge conference and had to get back because I had to report to unemployment. You know? You know, so, you know, you absolutely never know where the alcoholic who is still suffering is. He may have 5 years, he may have 10 years, he may have 20 years. You never know, you know. The idea is that we walk around these things doing the best we can, carrying the best message we can. And sometimes the best message that we're carrying is that we're okay, that we're sober, that we're getting through stuff. You know, John and I were talking about the second surrender. Oh, man, I hit it when I was 5.5 years sober. I mean, I literally destroyed my life and didn't drink. And then had to rebuild it, had to go back and look at actually who I was at and rework the steps. I mean, we all hit that second one, which is, I think, harder than the first one. And it seems to happen to a lot of us between 5 and 6 years sober. And a lot of us commit suicide around then. You know, we're not going to drink. You know, I'll kill myself instead. Ooh, that's a good idea. You know. And a lot of people disappear at that time. A lot of people drink again. Or a lot of people go crawling back to their sponsor and say, okay, what do I do now? You know, and the guy says, we better take the steps again. We better look at the traditions in your life. And so I've done that. What my life is like now is, well, you know, I like my life to be all good or all bad. You know, I hate this mixture stuff. You know, I hate good stuff and bad stuff. I mean, I just don't like that. I mean, I like it all one thing or the other. I can deal with famine, death, war, and pestilence. You know, I can deal with that, you know. I just can't deal with, you know, skin cancer. You know, that's what I got that. I'm one of those. I was a blonde, blue-eyed kid who fried myself every summer. You know, so now I'm paying for it. It started about I don't know 20 years ago. They started taking little bits and pieces of me away. Now I go to the doctor, and anything that looks weird, they cut off or freeze off or burn off or something. Yeah, well, man, it's just it's just lovely. I've had to give up my day job as strippogram, you know. But I'll tell you what a jerk I am. I mean, I'm absolutely, you know, one of the things that stuns me is my capacity to be an idiot. I mean, it's just, I'm, you know, after all this sobriety, I'm just, you know, in an instant I can turn into an asshole. I can't believe it. I mean, I just can't believe it. A couple of things. We live in a really nice area of Vancouver, and you have to go over this bridge. And what happens is 4 lanes of traffic go into 2 lanes of traffic. And so everybody has to kind of, we line up great. Canadians are great at lining up. That's one of the things that we pride ourselves on. And so everybody merges, you know, and you let the guy in front of you merge, and then you merge, and then the guy merges. It's just, it's lovely to watch. I mean, if you're from L.A., you can't believe it, you know. Anyway. So, one of my things in life, I'll tell you how spiritual I am. I have a real hard time with small blonde women in giant black SUVs. I don't know what it is. I just don't know what it is. They just piss me off. I don't know. You know, I just don't know what it is. So I'm merging one day, and I was driving Bonnie's car. She's got this Honda that's about this high off the ground. There's this giant, you know, and there's this, you know, this blonde in a black SUV, you know, her hair weighs more than she does, and she's got a cell phone and a cup of coffee. I don't know how the hell she's driving this thing, you know, probably with her skinny little knees, and she ain't merging. It's my turn. She ain't merging. So we're coming down to it, you know, side by side. I'm not giving up. And she's oblivious to it, you know. So Mr. AA here rolls down my window and goes, ha! Up high. Up high so she'll see it. And she doesn't see it because she's like, ha, ha, ha. You know. So finally she sees it and goes, ah! You know. And I thought, thank God I took the Easy Does It sticker off the back of the car. You know. Live and let live, you know. Or the let go and let God one. They got to take that one off. What a jerk. So anyway, I had this spot on the top of my ear, and my dermatologist said, whoops, we better have that looked at. So we went down to the cancer clinic, and the cancer clinic, and these six doctors come in, and they look at my ear, and they all go, and then they go out. And one guy comes in and says, okay, this is what we're going to do. And I said, wait a minute, there's six of you and one of me. How much does my vote count? They got no sense of humor, you know. So he said, this is what we're going to do. There's two alternatives. One of them is we can do radiation and 15 radiation treatments on this thing, or we can take the ear off and a lot of the flesh around it. But he said, don't worry, we can build a prosthetic ear that would connect to your skull with magnets. I said, gee, you're just a bundle of good news, Doc. And he said, well, those are the alternatives. He said, we make very nice prosthetics. I said, oh, well, Doc. And then, but, you know, I'm an alcoholic, and I've been around you guys just a lot. You know, we cry at the good stuff and laugh at the bad stuff, you know. So I click into that alcoholic thing, and I start vamping on this thing. Well, wait a minute. I mean, you know, maybe I could get different kinds of ears. You know, I could get like a Spock ear. That'd be fun. You know? Or I could get one with jewelry. You know, I could get one with a diamond in it, so, you know, stick that on. Or, you know, kind of like a mood ear. You know, whatever I was into, you know. And I said, and the other thing is I could, you know, at night I could take it off and just stick it on the refrigerator. You know. With a note that says, don't forget to pick up the eggs and the milk, you know. And the best thing is that, you know, when Bonnie's after me, I could just give it to her and say, here, talking to this, I'm going to take a nap. And this doctor is looking at me like, they may have to call in the psychiatry people. You know? This one's breaking down in front of me. Oh, man, yeah. So we did the radiation. So we irradiated my ear. Now, this is the denial part. Yeah. The denial part is I went in for radiation 15 times. At 7:30 in the morning so that I could go to work. And about the eighth time, the nurse said, why do you come in first thing in the morning? I said, well, to go to work. She said, most people go home. I said, oh, okay. I didn't know that. You know, my ears turn into jello, you know, at work. You know, I'm covering it with earmuffs and stuff. But then I start, you know, then I get into, you know, this is how big a jerk I am. I start getting to, wow, you know, it started to hit me, you know, that this could actually happen. And then I start going the other way. Oh, you know, what they're going to do is they're going to take it off, and then they're going to realize that it's really spread, you know. And so probably what they're going to end up doing is probably taking a good deal of my face away, you know. And what I'll then have to do is I'll probably wear a mask like the Phantom of the Opera, you know. And then they're going to ask me to speak at AA conventions, you know, and I'll have this mask on, you know, and people will think, God, he's so spiritual. I mean, man, you know, they took away half his face, and he flew across the country to carry the message. What a wonderful human being, you know. He slurps a little when he talks. Yeah, what a fabulous... What a dick I am. Man. So I got this weird ear and here I am. Yeah. Bonnie and I, Bonnie's an Al-Anon. She went a week after I got sober. I got a week on her. Doesn't make any difference to them, you know that. And, thank God for Al-Anon. I mean, I'm sober because I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm married because my wife's an Al-Anon. And, you know, an Al-Anon is just not somebody who's married to an alcoholic. You know, an Al-Anon is somebody who attends Al-Anon meetings, who works the steps and the traditions of Al-Anon, who sponsors other people in Al-Anon, and regularly attends meetings, involved in service. And my life has been graced by Al-Anon for almost 30 years. And they're funny, you know. The Al-Anons are funny. I love Al-Anon. I love Al-Anon. So occasionally Bonnie will have like an Al-Anon party. That's where everybody brings too much food. And, you know, 20 of them show up with enough food to feed an army. And then they split a bottle of wine. They get really, they get really crazy, you know. And then they argue about who's going to take it home, what's left. No, no, I can't take it home. I have an alcoholic at home. No, I don't want it. Oh, I never drink it. It'll just turn to vinegar, you know. Then finally one of them said, oh, I'll take it. And then the rest of them think, I wonder if she's in the right program. My sponsor and I, we go to dinner with Bonnie and his wife. My sponsor is a guy named Milton Merle, who's just a fabulous guy, and his wife is Ruby. And so we'll go out to Chinese food. And Bonnie and Ruby do this dialogue occasionally when they're feeling kind of frisky. They'll say, you want to split a beer? And then they say, oh, no, I had one 3 weeks ago. Well, maybe. Oh, I don't know. They go on and on and on and on. And finally they say, oh, all right. So then they get the beer and they pour it out. And then Ruby is never cold enough, so she puts an ice cube in hers. And then they take 3 sips and leave it. Will you finish that? Oh, God. They're just hysterical. Hallelujahs are the best. I'm really glad that this whole thing here is about families and about everything. I just got to briefly tell you about my daughter because you have beautiful and intelligent children, but I have Kate. And Kate is 22, almost 22 years old, and gorgeous, and has been raised in this fellowship. She just simply has been raised according to the principles of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. She has always been autonomous. We understand that parents do not govern. She has an extraordinary sense of self. She's a pretty fabulous girl. When she was in the fourth grade, she announced to me, she said, I'm the best artist in the class. And I said, oh, really? Who told you that, honey? She said, no one. And I thought, oh, man, you know, at that point I was 50 years old. I couldn't say that. You know, I thought, my God, my duty is not to suppress that feeling about herself, you know. And she has a great sense of that. We don't know which side of the fence she's coming down on because she likes to party hardy, but then so did her mother. So we don't know whether she's going to marry a drunk or be one, but the thing is she knows where the solution is real fast. When she was down in California going to school in Santa Monica, and one day she called and said, I need to go to a meeting, Dad. I said, whoa, okay, you know. So I get on the phone and get my best friend, Mary Murphy, and she calls, and they take her to the Pacific Group, Steve's Pacific Group. She meets Clancy and Clancy's daughter and everything else, and I thought, oh, this must be the moment. So I call Mary back the next day. I said, all right, Mary, how'd it go? She said, it's none of your business. She said, but she's not a drunk. And I said, oh, okay. So I called Kate, and I said, how was it? She said, you know, Dad, I'd had a lousy couple of weeks. Work was terrible. School was terrible. I was having trouble with my roommate. It was all... And I just needed to go somewhere with program people. And I thought, holy cow. No matter what kind of trouble she gets herself into in life, that's where she's going to go. And I'm so grateful for that. You know, and the interesting thing is she didn't call me. See, the reason that we're staying sober is for other people's kids. Our kids are never going to call us. But they're going to call the people that come to our house. They're going to call the people we know. And they're going to watch us. They watch us. They know what we're doing. And they absorb this fellowship. They do all the things that, you know, they've got all the information, you know. So what we've done, Bonnie and I, is we've broken a chain. We both come from generations of alcoholism. We've broken the chain because the solution is at hand for them, you know. And that may be the best thing that we do in our lives, you know, other than our own sobriety and other than our own recovery in Al-Anon, is to be there for other people's kids. We've done it. We've taken other people's kids to meetings and that kind of stuff. So here I am. That's my life. I've got a fabulous job. I run a theater in Vancouver. I'm doing all kinds of creative stuff and having a good time. And recently I had a little heart thing. They found out parts of my heart don't work quite right, and they're medicating it and doing all that kind of stuff. And I'm going to be just fine, but I've got to lose weight and I can't eat salt, so everything is like prison food now. And and I got to exercise and lose a lot of weight and all that boring stuff, so that I can live to be 120 years old with all my friends dead. It's just going to be really wonderful. So that's what I'm doing. So what I do is, the reason I come to these things when I'm asked, and I'm thrilled to be asked, is to report into you, because you have always remained, over the almost 30 years, my teachers. And so what I try to do is report to you how I'm doing and allow you to look at my life and you'll let me know how I'm doing. If you're going to judge me, be gentle. I know I've got a long way to go, but because of you, I've come a tremendous distance, and I'm deeply, deeply grateful to you. God bless you and keep coming back.